Hi there. Thank everybody for coming today. It's been a bit chaotic the last few days. We have come over from England. It's been very exciting so far. Thank you for all turning up. I'm Rob Karate. I'm the creative director at Preloaded. This is Andy Bonan, technical director, and Paul Canty, the business director. Essentially, we're going to cover the presentation from those three different angles, kind of technical, business, and creative. The organisers tell us that, you know, it's good to have a bit of conflict, and we never agree on anything anyway, so that should work fine. So essentially, we're going to tag team this presentation, so we'll be swapping between us throughout it, which is why we've had to get this synchronising going. And as you know, today we're going to be talking about the 10 Commandments of Nice. So in case you don't know Preloaded, we're an independent digital agency. We're 8 years old. There's 20 of us. We plan, design, and build all of our products in-house. We're driven by ideas, not technology. And we specialize in lifestyle, leisure, and entertainment and education products. And essentially, we do nice things. That's our tagline. We're from London, as I mentioned earlier. In case you don't know London, this is what the Lonely Planet Guide has to say about London, which is lovely. London is a city full of yobs, bigots, dirt, homeless people, and pigeons. Londoners will no more speak to a stranger than fly to the moon. Drinking to excessive, one of Britain's chief preoccupations. And not only that, we've got about 70 words apparently for the word drunk, so clearly it's very important to us. Also, the British devour internet porn at a faster rate than anyone else on the planet, which I think is quite an achievement, really.
That's not just us three.
Yeah, not between us three. It's kind of a cumulative thing. The British are also well up there in gold medal winners of swearing. And apparently, if we are asked not to swear, we don't really have very much left to say, which is clearly bollocks. So you should drop by and visit London. It's a great place. Obviously, I'm taking the piss, but it's good. So I'm going to start off today with our shout, engage thy audience, as the first commandment. And I've done a shaky start to that principle already. Anyway, be brave, take risks, and do things differently. And the example we've chosen today to demonstrate that is a project called We Feel Fine by Jonathan Harris and Sepp Kumar. And this is a project which trawls blogs across the internet for the words I feel or I am feeling, and essentially drags in all that data and displays it in unusual ways and different ways. And the thing that's interesting about this is the fact that the data itself is desperately dull, but what it does is it does it in a beautiful way, in the way you can filter the content by people's mood, people's age, where they are in the world, the weather, their gender, etc. And it's kind of quite an innovative way of kind of dealing with essentially lots and lots of dull data. Second one, be social. Receive and share and make your stuff useful. The great thing about, you know, what we have online these days is that there's loads of APIs out there that allow you to do stuff. Now, what we get asked to do all the time by clients is build things that play video, build things that are full of images, and they want us to build uploading engines and encoding engines and all this stuff. We spend most of our time convincing clients that actually you've got all these people registered at these other sites. Why don't we use those? So both these projects here kind of like case studies of like having to convince the client to kind of use existing technology, existing systems, which with, you know, millions and millions of users around the world, rather than reinventing the wheel each time. But trying to build these things into your projects of making things social is clearly very kind of on topic at the moment. Another thing that I think is really important is creating the illusion of depth, even when things are actually quite simple. This is a project by a company called North
Ready,
Kingdom in Europe.
Steady.
Just turn this down.
Go!
Which essentially, the game itself is a very, very simple, kind of almost kind of three-button pressing thing. There's not much to it at all. But what they managed to do is make it look almost like a console game. And throughout the game, there's about four or five different games peppered within a high level of video content, quite deep interaction, even though each game is very, very simple. Just let this video run through a bit. And this has kind of been sort of done I think it's just been launched in Europe, and it's currently kind of been translated to different territories. So this is the UK, the English version, which launched a few days ago. another thing that we like to do is entertain, make things fun and charming and add layers. This is a project we did for Hammer and Tongs, who you might know as directors of the Hitchhiker's Guide movie, which came out last year. And essentially, what we tried to do with this project was sum up everything about Hammer and Tongs. They didn't want a portfolio. They didn't want to have their films or ads or pop promos up there. They just wanted their own world. So this whole world is just full of kind of stuff that makes absolutely no sense at all, because that's basically what their stuff is like. And what we've done is create an engaging experience. Every time people come back, there's different events going on. Godzilla destroys the city, Back to the Future car travels through. You can pick people up and burn them at the end of the world if you feel inclined to do that kind of thing. And essentially sort of takes weather in live from meter data to affect the wind, the rain, the snow in the city. So every experience is different for every person coming back, and a lot of buzz was created by this, and people sort of saying, oh, have you seen this, have you seen that? And because there were so many different things in there, no two people had the same experience at the same time. So the other thing we do a lot of is educating people, and I think it's really important when you're teaching something to somebody, you get much better results if they don't know they're actually learning something. Also, people learn better through doing things. So this is a project called the Bow Street Runners, which is done by a company called Little Loud. And essentially, it's just a murder mystery on its surface. But beneath that, there's a lot of stuff teaching children and sort of and adults about the Bow Street Runners, which was the first police force in the world. And this was accompanying a TV show. So it was like running a parallel story, which was kind of purely online experience, 6 episodes of this. It's just launched, so I recommend also checking this out. Now this is Paul.
Yeah, this is the client bit. So as Rob said, I'm the kind of more the business director, so I kind of try and look after relationships within Preloaded with clients. And I guess I thought this was quite appropriate because quite often people don't love their clients, really. So it's kind of, you know, do unto clients as you'd have done unto yourself. First of all, let's clear up some misconceptions. Clients are not just people that give you money to do stuff. You kind of get that at Christmas and on your birthday. You know, clients expect something back from you, and they expect a dialogue. There's no such thing as a free meal ticket with clients. You don't get a free lunch. Clients are not out to get you.
Well, not you, no.
No, they're out to get you. Clients are not hateful, spiteful, clueless characters. Clients do not make decisions primarily to vex you. Clients are not necessarily stupid.
You do work at Preloaded, don't you?
Sometimes. Clients do not make the wrong choice on purpose. You give a client 2 things. One you prefer, they'll choose the other one 100% of the time. I've got more. Clients do not hate you and everything you stand for. And clients do not get off the phone with you and curse your very being. That's not strictly... I mean, some of these, they probably do. I just ran out of room on the slide. There were plenty more. Clients sometimes do some of these things, but, you know, not all the time. You have to remember that clients have hopes and feelings too. Yeah, you do. Client relationships are a little bit like personal relationships. I'm going to try not to push this analogy too far. The thing you need to do is kind of look to the future. Clients don't take you on just because you deliver them something. They take you on because of a relationship, and they want that relationship to grow, and they want it to be there in the future. I don't know about many other people in the room here, but Preloaded as a company, we're a service company. People come to us and we provide a series of services. One of the outcomes of that are deliverables, and the outcomes of those are projects that we go live. But for us, it's very much about the journey. And if you can make the journey good, then obviously clients stick with you. It's about the good times and the bad times. So, for example, you work with a client. You pitch for them and you win the project. Everything goes remarkably well. You deliver on time. They give you all the freedom you need creatively to create a wonderful, forward-thinking, groundbreaking piece of interactive work. You deliver it on time. It goes live. High fives all round. You win a South by Southwest award. Brilliant. Good times. Alternatively, you run out of money on the project. Key employees in a project leave. The client forces change, and you don't have any more money to pay for it, and you certainly don't agree with those changes. They deliver you a contract halfway through the process, which is essentially saying that if the project goes tits up, then you forfeit your house and probably your firstborn children. Bad times. So, where am I? Clients, there are ups and downs, good and bad times, sickness and health, till repitch, do you part. The thing is that clients need to feel loved. They need to feel that they're the most important person in your life. They want you to be their friend. If they feel good towards you, they're more likely to listen to you and more likely to empathize with what you're saying and more likely to let you do what you want to do. The key thing is that you have to make them believe that you're that they're the most important thing in your life. Even though you've got loads of other clients and you're working furiously to service them as well, don't really mention that to them. Maybe do if their context is right, but ideally you're focusing on them. Now, as Lou Reed said, almost take a walk on the client side. What you need to do is understand them, what's inside them, and what makes them tick. So if you can do that, then you've got a good inroad and you can understand where that needs to go. So I get to understand their goals and aspirations. And it's all about them at the end of the day. It's quite a selfish thing, but that's the way it is.
Oh, yeah.
I'm one way ahead. Thanks. So your job is about making clients' lives easier. That's what you need to do. And it's about making clients look good in front of their bosses and colleagues. Show that you care. If you kind of preempt things and exceed expectations, then everyone's a winner. So maybe even that, if that means setting the barrier a bit low at the beginning, that's fine. So, you know, it's Monday. You can do some design work. You can do it by Thursday. Tell them Friday. Deliver it Thursday night. So they get something before they expect it. You deliver early. Everyone looks great. It's just small things like that can really benefit the process. It's constantly surprising them. You know, answer questions before they ask the question. So it kind of makes you look good and raises trust. And if they trust you, then they'll let you push things a little bit. Deliver on your promises early and often. So if you say you're going to deliver something at a certain time, deliver it at that time or before. And if you're going to miss a deadline, we all miss deadlines, let them know as soon as possible, because then they're more likely to be forgiving if it's not their fault. Ask loads of questions. That's one thing that we kind of get, it gets mentioned to us in terms of feedback from clients, is that they actually quite respect the fact that we just ask loads and loads of questions. It kind of helps in two areas. One is that it kind of helps us find out what's kind of between the lines in briefs. But it also helps clarify things for clients, and it actually makes them think a bit more about what they're asking for. And you know, briefs can change through the kind of questions you ask. So it's a really valid kind of way of working. Share the experience. That's a really useful thing to do. If you get the client excited in what you're doing, enthusiasm is contagious. So if they're enthused, you're enthused. You're going to work together and hopefully remain excited throughout the life cycle of the project. It's working together is a real kind of, it's emphasizing that relationship thing. Adapt to your client's processes. If you work to your client's processes a bit, then that really helps a lot. We all have processes, presumably, where we work. We've been developing our process for about kind of, we went through a kind of a 6-month period of having reams and reams of paper about how a project kind of starts in the studio and goes all the way through to end and then aftercare and all that kind of stuff. But without considering how the client wants to relate to that, then it can actually really, really piss them off. So it's about having some kind of compromise in between. And finally, if there's one bit of advice that that I've learned is don't actually date your client. It's actually a boundary that you really shouldn't cross. I'll go no further than that. But it's one thing that it can be a bit of an emotional minefield, and it can last for a while. It can be quite good. I don't know if anyone in the room is dating a client at the moment. Good luck. I'm sure it'll go well. But if you're not dating a client, then I suggest don't do it. Sage-like words, I think.
Hi. I'm Andy. I'm going to talk about the technical side of things, and I'm going to start with the seven principles of user interface design. Depending on who you ask, there's anything up to 249 principles of user interface design. But we're going to stick to the generally accepted seven, partly because the first one of them is clarity. This is all about common sense, really. Make sure that there's good contrast for your text. Make sure buttons are clearly labeled as to what they'll do. You'll need to remember that not everybody uses a normal web browser to view your site. So this means you need to include clarity for alternative browsers such as screen readers too. So this is steps like making sure that all images on the page have useful text descriptions. Feedback. Make sure that the user knows their action has been received. This is particularly important with AJAX becoming a lot more common on the web these days, where the usual user interaction mold is broken. Normally, when they click on something, the browser's throbble would be telling them that a new page is loading. But with AJAX, this doesn't happen. So you have to design and code that feedback for them. Here's a good example of feedback where on Google Reader, when you click the refresh button to refresh your RSS lists, the button becomes disabled and the label changes to refreshing. The user instantly knows exactly what's going on. This is bad. This is just a form on some site that I found. It's got a whole great big block of text telling the user what to not to press submit more than once, and then explaining what to expect after they've pressed submit. This is basically just a poor substitute for good feedback. Affordance. This is making sure that the function of an object is clear to a user within that user's realm of experience. This is a good example, the tab bar in Firefox. The tabs look enough like document tabs in a normal filing system that, you know, even if somebody's never seen tabs in a GUI before, they're going to have a fairly good idea of what that tab's going to do. This is bad. This is the toolbar in MS Word's ribbon, where these are tabs, but they look like menu items, which is like breaking the user's expectations. The user expects menus to be in the top left-hand corner of a window in a MS application. They don't expect clicking on one of those things to change the state of the toolbar. And not only that, but only the currently selected tab looks like a tab. The rest of them are just plain words. Simplicity. If you overwhelm your users with options, they'll have no idea what to do. There's a generally accepted principle that you should only give somebody six options at a time. Any more than that, and it starts to become a bit confusing. So this is easily avoided by making sure they've only got the options that are relevant to their task at hand. So here's a file naming utility for IS10 called a better find a rename. It's a vertical list of options. The user goes through them in order, and they've only got to think about one thing at a time. It's really easy to follow. Now, this is the bad example. It's very bad. This is bulk rename utility. And this is basically what happens when you leave programmers in charge of interface design. I love that. Structure. Is your content structured in a straightforward way that's likely to meet your user's mental model of the data? This is where user testing can come in really handy, because the way that people use your site and the way they visualize the data on that site isn't necessarily the way that you would organize it yourself. So testing these things with users is a really useful way of finding out how they visualize that data. This is a great example. ASOS.com has a filtering, sync here. ASOS.com has a filtering system down the left-hand side, which means that if you get to this site and you're looking for a black jacket for around $100, it takes about 3 or 4 clicks to actually filter all of their products down to exactly what you're looking for. It's a really good way of shopping. This is a really bad example. This is a Norwegian gadget shop site, and it's famous for its like horror show of usability. Consistency. The buttons always appear in the same place. Is the logo in the same place on every page? Consistency needs to apply not just within the scope of your own site. It needs to apply within the scope of other websites as well, users' experience of other websites. So convention says that when you click on a website's logo, it takes you back to the home page. If you don't do that, then you're breaking that user's expectations. And tolerance. This is prevent your users from making mistakes, and if they do make mistakes, allow them to fail gracefully. So a basic example of this is 404 pages. So if your user has gone wrong and somehow ended up on a page that doesn't exist, you should provide them a link back to the home page, search, help, you know, ways of getting back to where they want it to be. And also, like warning messages, when you pop up a dialog box, you need to be concise, easy to understand, and it should not blame the user. So here's a good example of tolerance. This is a Yahoo 404 page. It's got help, link to home, and it's got search. You've got everything you need there to get to exactly where you're trying to get to. This is bad. This is an error dialog from WinSCP, which is just a simple SFTP program. Even if you read this massive, confusing error message, you're no closer to knowing what that is actually going to do when you click on any of those buttons. If you click the yes button, it could delete all your files or start a war. And that's it. That's your 7 principles of interface design. Hand you back to Rob.
Okay. Thou shalt not steal. I stole this one from the Bible, so that's a good start. Essentially, the digital world is global, but it's a really, really small one. So you just don't do these kind of things because you'd never get away with it. Essentially, don't thieve. Copyright, whether it's design, photo, sound, music, or text, is a very important issue online, increasingly so, especially with IP becoming an increasingly important thing. Also, from an ethical standpoint, stealing from either individuals or corporations, though obviously I much more believe that, you know, ethically it's worse to be stealing from individuals, is just not on. Imitation, at the end of the day, is also another form of theft. Is also the deepest form of laziness. Be inspired by other people's work and innovate beyond it. Combine ideas. Make them greater than the sum of their parts, but never just imitate. Following fashion, another terrible one. Fashions come and go. We've had eras of concentric circles and right-angled arrows and whatever design cliches being going on. Don't follow those because your work will date really, really quickly. There's too many sites that look like Apple.com already. There's too many sites that all look like Web 2. You don't stand out in a crowd, so it doesn't actually help in the long run. Do not covet your neighbor's designs. Don't pretend you designed something you didn't do. We've actually had people apply it preloaded telling us they worked on projects that we made. We know that they didn't work on them. But it's amazing how many people will try and sort of claim involvement in projects that they've actually had nothing to do or very little to do with. And do not cover your neighbor's designer or developer or producer. It's rude to poach. I don't know what it's like in the USA, but in the UK, there's a poaching frenzy going on as the skill shortage is meaning that people are in short supply. Attract people, don't poach people. The Lord loveth not these things.
Back to me. Thou shalt surround thyself with people more intelligent than thyself. This has got me a long way, actually, in this whole crazy industry. But I don't seem to be alone. There's a great quote I found by Henry Ford, which basically says, I'm not the smartest, but I surround myself with competent people. And that seems to be absolutely the way this industry works now. People need to know a lot nowadays. It's there's so much going on. There's constant innovation, constant technological advances. And as all that moves on, you just can't hope to kind of know everything. a long time ago, when I just left art college, I was trying to make money and with my artwork, and I obviously couldn't. So I managed a bar, and I had this kind of ethos where I would never ask someone to do something that I wasn't prepared or could do myself. So whether that was kind of, I don't know, cooking or cleaning toilets or all these kind of things, I'd make sure that I could do all that kind of stuff. And then when I fell into what was called new media back in the early to mid 90s, doing CD-ROM stuff, everyone came at it from a very different kind of angle. Now you're working with actors and you're working with illustrators and designers and developers and all these kind of different, very specific skill sets, all kind of working together. And that's kind of continued. And you can't expect to do everything yourself. There's just no way. And the actual results are always going to be stronger if you have everyone working within their skill sets together. I mean, people used to be much more, not more multi-skilled than they are now, but there was a requirement a few years ago where you had to be able to do everything. Designers would do information architecture and all these kind of things. But now it's getting a bit more segmented. But yeah, I think that's just naturally the way the way it's got to go. So I think what comes out of that is basically don't try and know everything. You can't do it. But be informed. It really helps if you don't know something. If you're in a client meeting or if you're out representing the company and you don't know something, defer, come back, ask. Just don't be tempted to wing it, because your team will hate you when you come back and say, "Hey guys, I reckon we can do this. What do you think?" And then they actually, yeah, they curse you pretty badly. Again, speaking from experience. So you don't need to have all the answers yourself. It's really fundamental that you don't. Surround yourself with good people. That's what I've done, and it's worked pretty well for me. And if you can't surround yourself with good people, get their telephone numbers and phone them. Another way, a great way of kind of keeping yourself out there is networking. We're all here networking today, so it's a great way of keeping yourself where you want to be. Now, it's a necessary evil, and it's something that it's really good to be good at. But I must confess that it really isn't always fun. It's a bit weird because when over here in Austin, it's fucking brilliant networking. You can walk down the street and you're networking. People actively come and shake your hand and want to get to know you in a kind of a non-threatening or a non-kind of awkward way. And I think Austin's a real benchmark for this. You should try it in London. Everyone's pissed anyway, but it's crazy. Yeah. Oh, busted. Deirdre. Yeah, hello. You know what? I haven't. Yeah, okay. I'll change this screen. sorry, generalizing a bit, but yeah, absolutely right. So it can be daunting. Like sitting up in front of a group of people talking about stuff is a bit daunting. So there are actually courses you can go on for this kind of thing. And there was a great one that Rob and I went to in London a couple of years ago. There's this great, great bloke. He's kind of a motivational speaker and kind of a networker. And his main remit was to get you noticed. It's all about getting noticed and making people remember you, to the point where he would have, he got a dot matrix name badge and, you know, kind of wore it with pride, and it scrolled across with his name and his telephone number and his email address. He was like, another sage-like piece of advice was, on your business card, put your photo, because then people will remember you. And he took this to quite an extreme level, because on his photo, he was, it wasn't just his face, he was double gunning. He was like that. We kept the card, actually. It was quite impressive.
He was memorable for all the wrong reasons.
He was wicked. And so, he would do things like, okay, go into twos, and one of you talk to the other guy about your favorite animal, and then do it back, and it'll be great. And but it actually worked, because everyone kind of united against him. So it actually gave people something of a kind of a something in common to talk about. And I think that's what it's all about. It's finding that commonality. And and as a starting point, and then you can kind of build on it, share experiences, share knowledge, all that kind of stuff. So yes, it's a key thing to look for in a networking situation. I think I forgot to press the button a bit there. Oh no. So yes, it's not. You're not networking to go out and get business. That's not what it's about. It's about learning, keeping yourself in the right context, and that's why we're here, as well as the parties and the booze.
And swearing.
Bollocks. Okay, who's next? That's... Oh, no, it's still me, actually. Sorry. I do go on. Okay, we're all pioneers in this room here, and I think we can kind of... Pioneering, you can share experiences with a fellow community, and it's not about giving away competitive advantage. So it's very unlikely you're going to say something which is going to kind of screw you over and give someone else, you know, the opportunity to screw you over. It's about sharing, and that's, let's face it, that's what made the internet great anyway. Surround yourself by people who have made mistakes. I mean, everyone's made mistakes, some more than others, but everyone makes mistakes. We all do it. It's a human trait. Some people have made the mistakes we're just about to face, and vice versa. So, you know, it's one thing to, it's about sharing, kind of preventing and helping, and because it moves the industry on, and that's what we kind of that's what we try and do. It's fundamentally how we learn. I got a great quote from Winston Churchill actually, which was he's said some great stuff in his time, bless him. But the one that I found was. Success is the ability to go from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. And I think that that's absolutely applicable. I mean, almost in every project you do, there are fuck ups and there are issues that, but when you try and get around those and try and fix them and, you know, cure those bugs, it's actually what you come out with is a much richer thing. So I've got some other ones from him, but I won't do them today. So yes, it's, people like to share advice and ideas. Again, it's a human trait. It's a bit like talking about yourself. It's, you know, people quite like doing that. So, you know, sharing experiences, very positive thing. And I must confess that apart from Chinwag, Austin is probably one of the best places to do this. We've been here on and off kind of for the past 5 years or 6 years maybe. And it's just great. We keep coming back. Yeah, that's me.
Okay. Thou shalt not believe the hype. Chuck B. I'm going to talk about the hype cycle or hype curve, which is a graph that maps technology's perceived capability to its actual capabilities over time. So there is one. And it's quite a simple concept. It's as soon as a little bit of buzz starts up around an emerging technology, the expectations and excitement gather momentum faster than technology is able to mature. So once everybody starts to realize that it's not quite up to the job yet or whatever, we get a dip in the perception curve, often back to below the actual capabilities because people are just disillusioned. After this, things start to realign as the technology matures. So if you've been in digital media more than about a month, you've probably witnessed at least two technologies go right the way along this graph. One technology that you will have witnessed go most of the way through this curve is Ajax. Back in the old days, we used to work with the XML HTTP request object, which is a really real mouthful for a not very sexy technology. But that's been around since like 1999 in IE, 2002 and all the other major browsers. But then in 2005, along comes Ajax. A nice, sexy name. But the term was coined by a really interesting guy called Jesse James Garrett from Adaptive Path. And if you don't know Jesse James Garrett, I suggest you look up his books. He's a really good guy. But it was intended to refer to a whole methodology, not just the XML HTTP request object. But he just wanted to give a name to these techniques so that he could describe it or talk about it to clients and colleagues. So armed with its exciting new name, the hype kicked in. And in a very short space of time, the web was awash with really poorly realized bits of Ajax where people didn't really understand the whole kind of concept of interaction design in the way that Garrett and Google do. So in the case of Ajax, it wasn't so much the developers who became disillusioned. It was more the users and the clients because it wasn't living up to everything that was promised. But the reality of it not living up to the hype was due to a lot of poor implementation. But we're kind of, you know, these days, we're back out of the valley. There's a lot of people doing very, very cool stuff with it. You know, in particular, the Google apps are still just amazing. But the people's perception of technology is now pretty well aligned with its capabilities, and more often than not these days, it's implemented well. Also these days, you can't really talk about hype curves without talking about Ruby on Rails. The hype curve diagram could have been invented to describe the life of Rails. And this was a technology that I got really sucked in at the hype stage, like a couple of years ago when the 15-minute blog tutorial appeared on the Rails website. I sat there watching that thinking, hey, this is magic. But the hype that surrounded Rails in the early days was pretty quickly followed by mumblings of discontent when people realized that it possibly wasn't quite up to what they thought it could do. And saying they were going to go back to whatever they'd been using before. And it's important to say that this wasn't Rails' fault. The technology is sound and the concept is sound. It was just the expectations were unrealistic. Rails couldn't actually write their app for them while feeding them pizza and Dr. Pepper. So these days I'll put Rails about halfway along this graph. The hype is over, the trough is over. That's actually starting to find its place on the web with a lot of really good applications, outside of the excellent 37 signal stuff. This is in part down to this hype cycle and the fact that right at the start, when it was getting hyped up, an awful lot of developers get involved in the project and start contributing, and it brings the maturity up of the framework, brings it up and a lot quicker than would otherwise happen. So what's getting hyped at the moment? Just mention a couple of things that we think are a little overhyped. These are things that are going to be right at the front of this graph at the moment. PaperVision. This is a Flash 3D engine, which, if you haven't seen it, is starting to appear all over the place. And it's never been used for anything appropriate. And in our office, it's becoming known as fucking PaperVision. Here's a Nike site done in it. It has to give you instructions on how to navigate the site. And you're just moving around a room in 3D. It's basically VRML from 1994, but done in Flash. Pointless. Next one, Erlang. If you haven't heard of Erlang yet, it's because it's right at the start of that hype curve. In about 6 months' time, you'll have clients ask you to do unsuitable things in Erlang as it hits the top of it. Next one, Flex. Show me a Flex site, and I'll show you a site that should have been built in HTML. And pair programming. If you don't know what pair programming is, this is a concept where you get two programmers working on the same document at the same time. One of our senior developers described it as having an extra nerd backseat coding doesn't really help all that much. I've just realized one that I forgot to put. It's like a live spell checker. And I've just remembered one that I forgot to put in, which is Silverlight. But the reason I didn't put it in really is because it hasn't hit the top of that curve yet, and it's probably never going to.
Ooh. Ouch. Mind you, I did recommend to Microsoft in about 96 to buy Future Splash, and they asked what was that, and now it owns the web as Flash.
What about it? I think Air is pretty exciting, actually. I don't think it's really getting it hyped up as much as it deserves.
See, developers can be nice. Love Thy User. Essentially, these days we adopt a user-centered approach to all our projects, and it's one we definitely recommend. I say these days because I think traditionally, I don't know whether it was because we were smaller at the time or whether times have changed, we didn't follow a process which really was about the user. It's probably a bit to do with wankers all being designers. I am a designer before anyone gets upset. And obsessing a bit more about what you want to do and what's cool rather than thinking about the user so much. So these days, whenever a project comes in, we're much more careful and much more considerate about what we're doing. Clients are obviously the people paying us, but 9 times out of 10, they're not the user unless we're making a CMS or an intranet system for them. But they obviously come with us with very fixed ideas of what they think they want. It's often a very subjective view, and it's not necessarily a correct one. because they're thinking about their business needs over the needs of their users or their potential audience. So what we do to get around this is by creating personas for likely users and scenarios that those personas might go through. Is that the right slide? Yes, it is. Essentially, a persona is a conceptual model of a person who's likely to use the site. Primary personas, essentially, are the people you most want to use the site, and they're the people that you will aim the product to meet most of, if not possible, all of their needs. Scenarios are essentially things that they're likely to want to do at your site. So you'll plan scenarios out and make sure that all the functionality they're likely to want to need is there, all the information they're likely to want to need is there. And essentially that makes for better products. So whether it's they're wanting to purchase a particular product in three clicks or upload and share a photograph as quickly and easily as possible, scenarios allow you to kind of test the rationalization that you're doing with your designs and your technical build. The other thing you can do using this process is essentially it enables you to establish and prioritize the features. Just checking the slides. So essentially it allows you to sort of look at all of the things that a user might possibly want to do and then start to prioritize them in terms of, well, does my primary user want to do that? Can the client afford it? Is there time? And then finding a happy balance between those things, which, you know, keeps the client happy, is a plausible thing for the team to actually build and the user gets value out of. Another thing we would always recommend is testing the product thoroughly. We do this in several stages. One thing that we do is paper testing. We can do that with wireframes or sketches. We can do that internally with people on the team. It's not necessarily a thing that requires an external individual to do that. We also, something's going on with my slides. We also tend to like to create basic prototypes. So these are essentially HTML versions of our wireframes with very, very little design involved in them, because we're interested in people's experience of the functionality, the way the information is laid out and the content, rather than how the design is made. So we tend to do all our testing with an independent lab. It gives us the opportunity to stand back and watch from a distance rather than interfere with the testing. It gives us credibility in terms of to the client in terms of when that feedback comes back about the requirements that the client might be resisting doing, for example. We can prove that through testing that users agree with a principle that we would rather follow. Also getting clients involved in these tests makes them buy into the process. When they start to witness users doing things they didn't expect, they get very much more involved in what's going on. And also it gives you the opportunity to actually revise the site during the testing. If you do testing over a couple of days, you can iterate through different designs, different structures and ideas really, really quickly. So if you have different ideas you want to explore, that's easy. If you find users aren't behaving the way you expected them to and they're not doing things that you hoped they would do, you can start to tweak the stuff on the fly. And also when you build something like an HTML prototype, you can also then start to use the templates you've used for that to start to overlay the final design. So this is the process we followed for a project for Channel 4. So it was a two-day process to get those designs refined down, the wireframe layouts refined down, until we then were able to go away and design with all the knowledge that we had on board and complete buy-in from the client, which is what makes all the difference in these things. Once a project is in development, we always encourage on an iterative process in terms of small and regular updates, so the client can always see what's going on. If you make a mistake, they're not big deals. You can step back really, really easily. And this process can be applied to anything. I mean, we apply it to HTML sites, or the one I just showed you, and just as easily apply it to games as well. So this is a project we did called Launchball, which is up for an award this evening. Started out as paper sketches in which we got kids to kind of tell us what they thought of the way the things would work, to wireframes through to designs. And this is a quick video of the product itself, in which all of these things were all tested with the target audience, which was a group of 8 to 16-year-old children. And it's a game that teaches kids about physics. But again, as I was saying earlier, they don't feel like they're learning stuff, so they actually get very much engaged with it. There's also a level editor, so they can create their own levels. So again, as I was talking about earlier, in terms of just giving the opportunity for people to create and share stuff. So there have been some like 1.2 million levels created since this went live. In October last year, and it's just done phenomenally well. We've crashed the Science Museum servers, which is always a good sign. And yeah, people on Dig were calling it more addictive than crack, which I'm not sure whether that's actually appropriate comment for something aimed at children, but you know, it seemed to do the trick and got us to the audience. So okay, I think it's
over to Paul. Yes. Okay. Yeah. The kind of final bit about client service now. Client service isn't always about doing... actually, I'll tell you what it is first. Dash will say yes, even when thou meanest no. So can be difficult at times, can be a bit tricky, but you get so much further with the power of yes. It's not really about doing what clients want. It's about understanding what they need. So it's kind of... You have to kind of be careful about the relationship from the beginning, really. Don't just follow orders. A lot of designers and some agencies do just take orders from clients and just do what the clients are asking for. This doesn't work. It can be really, really divisive, and it creates something of an us and them relationship, and it can really demonize a client in the studio. You can often hear dreadful shouts of anti-client slogans around the studio. Now, obviously, clients don't want this. Clients want you to do what you're best at. They want to push you. They want you to be creative, and they want you to do it well. On the whole, don't be their bitch. That will end in tears. Because what happens is that clients start telling you what to do. They start making creative decisions. They're not happy with how you execute those creative decisions. There's constant criticism. When you constantly criticize, you begin to make mistakes. It doesn't help. The passion just evaporates from the whole project. The project suffers. Ultimately, the project would suffer. And getting to that ultimate end is just horrid. So, we had a relationship in Preloaded where this happened. We were taken on by an agency who didn't really have any digital experience, but somehow they won. It's an above the line agency, quite a big one, and they won this piece of work. So they phoned us up and asked us to do it, and they had a very specific kind of creative director who had lots of experience above the line, won loads of awards, but felt that she could actually do web design. It took us 3 months of constant wrangling before we actually just thought, well, let's just do what they say. They're not listening. We'll just do it. And we did. And we produced it and we released it. It wasn't great. The experience was dreadful. I don't think we'll be working with them again. But we made the best out of what was there. And the whole experience and the whole service that we provided just wasn't what we wanted to do at the start. So that was quite significant bad times. What we want to do, bad times, what we're trying to do is define the client's goals and objectives up front. Because once you can do that, then you're kind of laughing, really. Because then you can suggest a solution that the best suits the client. So if we're being asked by the client to do a flash site, and we believe that HTML is a HTML solution is a more effective one, then it's our duty to say so. And it's our duty to try and get this across to the client. And we can do that in a number of ways. It's kind of protecting them from what they want. What if you can do that and help them understand your point of view, you're on the way. And it can be quite difficult, but it's quite an emotive subject, especially with design and with creativity generally. So the best thing to do, as kind of Rob touched on before, was about testing, getting user testing involved. It takes the subjectivity out of it, and it actually makes, and especially if the client is involved, it actually aligns you and you actually produce something that people want to use. What you need to do is essentially do it their way at the beginning. Show you're on side, but move it on. So use if you're in their heads, understand what they want, use that as a starting point, and then say things like, you know, well, from that, we've taken that idea, that kernel of an idea, and we've created this. And so you kind of start the dialogue forwards, and you kind of bring them with you. if you're really thorough in your thinking, then and you've really thought it out, then you can usually get clients on your side. It's the power of reason. And it can often pay dividends, especially if they're involved in that thinking. Yes, if you where am I now? Yes, know what they like. So if you're in their heads and you know what they like, that's a great starting point. Involve them in the process. If they're involved in the process, they'll have ownership over the work. They make decisions, you make the decisions, you both win. Compromise, that hellish word, compromise. As creatives, it's very hard to deal with compromise, but you kind of have to. But if everyone in the all the stakeholders compromise, and you get to that point, it's going to make a better project. That's that. Don't act as though you know more about your client's business than they do. You probably don't. They could be new to the role, but they still are in that position of guardian of their brand. Treat them as the experts they are, and then you'll have a better chance of persuading them to follow your lead. Use the classic tactics to dissuade them from pushing what they want. So, you know, if they're asking for something kind of halfway through the project, which is well out of scope, and they don't want to go through change control and all that kind of stuff, you just say, well, yep, we can do that. Well, I'll just work out how much that's going to cost and how much it's going to delay your deadline by. And then they invariably pull back from that. So, yeah, it's much easier to get buy-in if you say yes rather than no. Remember the power of yes. Yes is nice. Do nice things. That's it. We're done. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Has anyone got any questions at all?
Yeah, we can put that on.
Yeah, it's quite big at the moment, actually. But we can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant.
No more questions? Cool.
Thank you.
Thanks ever so much for coming. Cheers.